This podcast is brought to you by rachelcochrane.com. Ghost Stories, written and read by the Easington Writers.
Pink Suede Boots, Mavis Farrell. Ellie stands poised on the very edge of the pond, her small suede boots darkening from pink to red and from red to black as moisture from the rain-flattened grass soaks into them. She's supposed to be safe at home in the terrace of old colliery houses, arching like a dinosaur's back down the slope towards the pond. A train flashes past along the embankment, too high up for Ellie to see. But she knows it is the train. She knows the sound well. Ellie had told a lie. Her mother, coming home exhausted from the night shift at the care home, had been met at the door by Mel, dancing about from one foot to the other as she crammed on her crash helmet. "Carol, Ellie's got bellyache, so I didn't take her to school. She hasn't eaten. Gotta go. Late for work already." Then she was gone. Ellie did have a sort of daddy once. His face is a blur now, but she remembers the smell of his sweat and the funny cigarettes. He's gone to Hartlepool to be somebody else's daddy. Ellie doesn't miss him. Ellie loves Mel. She loves the big smiley mouth with the curled up corners and the spiky black hair which flattens under her crash helmet and needs to be re-spiked with gel. Mel is the reason why Ellie told the lie about the bellyache. "Lesbo, lesbo, your mum's a lesbo," the big girls in the schoolyard chanted every day. Ellie didn't know what they meant, but she dreaded the sound of cruelty in their voices. Carol checked Ellie's temperature, made her some toast, and they snuggled under a blanket on the battered couch to watch CBeebies. Carol didn't mean to sleep. She would carry the weight of self-blame for a very long time. Ellie, bored with the Tomblyboos, got dressed in her new puffer jacket and pink suede boots, and wandered down the pond to look for newts. The dark surface of the pond is littered with empty crisp packets and bobbing lager cans. A plastic Asda bag inflates like a sail where the light breeze catches it. An abandoned broken fishing net and a seaside pail lay scattered nearby. Ellie finds a stick and leans right over the pond to stir the murky water. Wet, curly tendrils of dark hair cling around her elfin face in the autumn damp morning as her eyes scrunch up in concentration. Finding no newts in the stagnant mess, she looks around for something else to do. An elderly couple and their overweight Jack Russell pass under the railway bridge onto the circular path. Each foot is placed with careful precision. Ellie follows. They turn right along the edge of the railway towards Foxholes Dean, but Ellie goes the other way, towards the beach banks and the cliffs. Droplets of last night's rain cascade from the red and yellow leaves as a blackbird abandons its perch and goes to feed on jewelled berries. Wet fallen leaves smell of autumn as the fat dog sniffs and worries about, looking for rabbits. The old couple, Robert and Lydia, tired already, look in dismay at the filthy tramp who dares to sit on their seat at the mouth of Foxholes Dean. They need their usual halfway rest, but the tramp smells very badly of filth and urine and alcohol. Exchanging glances which say all, they have no choice but to lean on the railings and look out over the grey sea towards Teesport and beyond. Their dog runs to greet the tramp, but he swears in a rasping voice and frightens it away. Ellie wipes her runny nose on the sleeve of her puffer as she kneels on the wet path, watching snails with striped shells as they slither along on their journey through the remains of the fallen rain. Ellie wonders where they are going. How long will it take them? And what are they thinking about as they go? The old couple trudge towards her, Robert limping, and Lydia looking across as she shouts for the fat dog, who, as usual, takes no notice at all. "What are you doing on the beach by yourself?" Lydia asks Ellie. Ellie doesn't answer. She doesn't exactly know what she is doing here. "Where do you live?" asks Robert kindly. "Number 11 Conway Street," Ellie says. "Does your mammy know you're here?" Ellie looks back over her shoulder to the railway bridge, where a young couple are just coming through. She nods in their direction. "My mam doesn't mind," she says. Robert and Lydia continue on their way. On passing the young couple, Lydia says, "Don't you think your little girl is too far ahead? The cliffs are very dangerous." "We don't have a little girl. What's the problem?" Old Robert explains, and the young ones, seeing how upset he is and how tired they both look, agree to find the little girl and take her home to Conway Street. The young couple walk the whole of the circular path, and finding no one at all, hurry to Conway Street, where they bang on the door, wake Carol, and ask if she has lost a little girl. The police are everywhere. Houses are being searched, fields combed, and the tracker dogs are sniffing frantically as they quarter the steep overgrown sides of Foxholes Dean. The golden hour has gone, and the helicopter has been scrambled. It putters overhead, circling the beach banks, the cliffs and the sea, as morning wears on and optimism wears out. Lydia, hearing the helicopter, goes out into their garden. She watches it as it circles. Fear explodes inside her as she clutches her chest and vomits on the cabbages. Robert, never any good in a crisis, fills the watering can and washes the vomit away before telephoning the police to tell them about the tramp. The watery sun retreats as dark clouds stack up and the sky lowers itself onto the sea. At 17 minutes past four that afternoon, the tracker dogs find a pair of small pink suede boots, scattered well apart in the thick undergrowth of Foxholes Dean. When the tide retreats an hour later, taking all hope with it, the helicopter crew locate a lifeless body rolling on the pebbles at the bottom of the cliffs. The day drags itself to evening, and then, in the click of a light switch, the day has gone. Carol and Mel live in a nightmare of fear and dread, from which there is no waking. Mel goes into the kitchen to make coffee and hears the end of a message on the policewoman's radio. "The unidentified body is that of a late to middle-aged man, by his appearance probably a vagrant and as yet unidentified." "Mammy, Mel, I'm back. I've had such a very exciting day, and I'm very sorry to have been out so long. I know I've been a bit naughty, but I'm so hungry." Ellie stands inside the kitchen door, bits of bracken stuck in her tousled hair, face and clothes filthy, but she's very much alive. On her feet, she wears a pair of well-worn, brown leather T-bar sandals with crepe soles, a type not seen for 50 years or more. "Ellie, Ellie, are you all right? Where have you been? Thank God you're home." Carol and Mel hug Ellie and smile through rivers of tears. Much later, when the police and the doctor have given up on their questions and examinations and Ellie had been bathed and fed and put to bed, Carol asks Ellie what really happened. Tell me and Mel about your exciting day, Ellie. We won't be a bit cross with you. Honest, we won't, and we're dying to know. Well, you fell asleep, and I went to look for Newt, but there wasn't any. So I went for a walk along the path, and there was this old man who said he would show me some rabbits in the woods, but there wasn't any rabbits. And he gave me money and said my boots and leggings were wet, so I should take them off. I took my boots off, and then I got a bit frightened of him. He smelled horrible. Carol gasps and shudders, but Mel put her arms around them both and encouraged Ellie to carry on with the story. They need to know. Just then, two girls came. They shouted at him really loud and told him he was a dirty old man, and he ran away towards the cliffs, and we held hands and ran the other way. I'm sorry, ma'am, I lost my new boots, but Lily gave me her sandals. She says her feet never feel the cold. What happened next, Ellie? Asks Mel. We went to Mr. Henry's shop and bought some sweets with the smelly man's money. Then we played all day in the welfare park. Did you see the people looking for you? Asks Carol. Yes, but I was a bit scared to come home. And Annie said that no one can see me if I'm with them. It was really fun, and I've had a lovely day. Where do the girls live? Asked Mel. Their house has been knocked down now. They used to live in Air Street. But they live in the old school. Not my school, you know, the old one. Carol and Mel look at each other and settle Ellie down to sleep, relieved that she's unharmed. But Carol wonders about post-traumatic stress syndrome. Ellie seems unharmed and happy. And there is no more talk of the events of that day and the mysterious girls in the months to come. It was as if the day had never been. The old infant school stands, crumbling and gaunt, with boarded up windows like blinded eyes. A thicket of shrubs and small trees thrust their way up through the cracks in the playground, providing night perches for small birds and a hunting ground for feral cats. On cold winter evenings, darkness falls early, and most people prefer to be at home with the curtains closed tight against the night and the central heating turned up high. The old couple are making their way home from the library. They are late because Lydia had felt poorly, and Esther the librarian had kindly made them both a cup of tea. They turn at the shrill sound of childish laughter as they pass the schoolyard. Robert wonders how the children manage to climb over the high iron railings with the spikes along the top. Lydia clutches her chest as the pain comes back. She holds out her hand to the little girl with the lovely face. And before the blackness comes, she wonders why the child has bare feet on such a very cold night.
A Quiet Night In by Terry Dobson. The girls giggle as they sit around the table in the makeshift Ouija board. Candles flicker on the fireplace, casting eerie shadows around the dimly lit room. Come on, fingers on the glass, Tanya said. It's Tanya's parents' house, so she naturally takes charge. Her parents are out for the evening at the Colliery Club, so they have the house to themselves. The girls place their index fingers on the glass in the centre of the table. Is there anybody there? Said Tanya in a put-on quavering voice. Is there anybody there? Another shared giggle. Then the glass moves slowly at first, then speeds up and touches the piece of paper with yes written on it. The girls squeal. You pushed that, Julie says to Tanya. I didn't. Honest, Tanya, indignant, replies. Who are you? Tanya asks, this time a bit shakily. The glass moves to touch the letter S, then quickly across to the right for the A, and then to the M, then it stops. Sam, is your name Sam? Tanya asks. The response comes quickly, yes. Tanya then notices that Jackie has taken her finger off the glass and is hiding her face, which seems pale. She's shaking. Jax, what's wrong? Tanya asks. Jackie shakes her head and draws in a deep breath. I had a brother called Sam, but he died when he was a baby, she says, trembling. Tanya stares at Jackie in shock for a moment. She looks down at the glass. Are you Jackie's brother? She asks hesitantly. No, comes the reply. Tanya thinks for a moment. Sam could be either a boy's or a girl's name. Are you a boy? The glass slides to touch the paper marked no. So you're a girl? Tanya asks. Once again, there's a negative response. The girls look at one another. Are you human? Tanya asks. The glass seems to take on a life of its own, moving so quickly that the girls almost lose touch with it. No, comes again. An animal. The glass indicates yes. Tanya thinks for a moment. Are you a cat? Once again, the answer is an emphatic no. A dog. At this, the candle flame seems to stretch upward for about 3 feet, making the room seem a lot brighter. Then a gust of air blows them out. The glass flies from the table and smashes against the wall. The girls scream in terror, jump up and knock down chairs in their haste and huddle together for comfort. Their hearts thump, their mouths are dry and they shiver and cry. They cling together for what seems like hours, but it's only about 10 minutes. Everything is quiet, very quiet. They calm down a little. Tanya slowly stands and slides her hand along the wall until she finds a light switch. She flicks it on, and to the girl's relief, there is light at last. Let's not do that again, says Tanya. The others nod and agree emphatically. Jackie has to go home. The others are sleeping over with Tanya. Putting on her coat, Jackie walks to the door, saying goodbye to everyone. Opening the door, she hears a vicious growl. Looking down on her is a huge black dog, teeth bared, drool dripping from its jaws. She screams.
The Iron Gates, Mavis Farrell. The horse stumbled on the rough track, rattling the cart from side to side, pitching the woman forward on the hard wooden seat. She clutched the lifeless body of a small boy to her breast. Propped together in a corner of the cart sat two other boys. They looked near death. The gates were opened by an irritable man, disturbed from his supper by the clanging of the iron bell. Best get the bairns in quick, grunted the carrier. The fever's very bad, Bill, very bad. Good night and God bless, my boys, said the woman. Be good for the nurses and say your prayers. Tom, you look after your brothers. I'll be back for you all when the fever's gone. And that's a promise. She kissed each in turn and sobbed as she gave the little one into the arms of the carrier. The next day, Tom, burning with the fever, winced at the jangle of keys and the clip-clop of heels on the wooden floor. What have you to report this morning, Wilson? The two youngest little brothers from Easington died in the night, but the older one is still with us and putting up a fight, matron. Tom, on hearing this, felt only shame at his failure. He stopped fighting. Tom was cold to the bone, lying on the marble slab. A sickly sweet smell filled the room. He tried to think where he had smelled it before and remembered a dead badger once found in the dean. Winter's brown leaves rustled and rattled under the ill-fitting wooden door as a rat sniffed and twitched its way in. Through the strange square window set in the roof, the face of the moon cast Tom a silver glance. His eyes snapped open as he threw off the transparent sheet. He went to find his brothers. "Wake up, little Alfie, it's time to go." Tom kissed the icy cheek. Thin arms wound around his neck as he lifted his youngest brother down. "We've got to find our Joe." The boys looked under the sheets, but the others were sleeping very soundly, not moving, not waking. "Box," shouted Alfie. There was Joe, sleeping the sleep of the dead. They kissed him, they tickled him, and blew in his face. "Come on, Joe, we'll miss our mam when she comes for us." They watched and they waited. Joe awakened at last as the watery sun rose. "You always was a good sleeper, our Joe." Through the pointed arch, they found their cut-down clothes and well-cobbled little boots. It was good to get out of the silly white dresses. "Let's get out, lads." Looking back over his shoulder, Tom was surprised to see no empty slabs, no disturbed sheets, and the lid was neatly back in place on Joe's box. Every day the boys walked down the long drive past the pine trees to the iron gates to look for their mother. Their mother never came. People came to read the progress bulletins posted on the gates. Some left food parcels for their loved ones. But no one was allowed entry. Thorpe was a fever hospital. The boys asked everyone about their mother. "Have you seen our mam? Has she come for us?" But no one could see them, and no one could hear them. Alfie cried pitifully, and Joe cried in anger, but their mother never came. The boys played a lot in the sun, eating from the kitchen if they were hungry, and sleeping under the soft blankets at night on a shelf in the clean laundry room. They kept very busy. There was the vegetable patch to tend, hens to feed, and rabbits to play with, and all the wild birds to watch. The swifts came from Africa in the summer and nested under the eaves of the pavilion wards. Joe wished he could fly away with them too, but Tom said, "No, we must wait for our mother." The long years passed. People came and went, but these three little brothers stayed at Thorpe. After the war, fewer people had fevers. Instead of sick people, women came to have their babies. New people came every day. Patients, doctors, and nurses. Tom inspected each new face. During this time, he really thought his mother had come. Tom always did the ward rounds with Matron. He jangled his imaginary keys, peering into all the cots to inspect the babies. "You've got her off to a tea," Joe said, "wobbling bum and all." Then Tom saw his mother. At least he thought so. But when he got close, he found the sad woman with the empty cot was not his mother at all. He followed her up the path to the nursery, where she cried and crooned over a tiny frail baby, as transparent as a newly hatched bird. "Come on, baby Tommy. Don't die like my brothers. Get well, be strong and live," she said. Tom knew then that the woman was his baby sister Ellen, all grown up. He puzzled how this could be. Tom spent all his days and nights looking after Ellen's baby. He stroked its arms and legs and sang sweet songs when it cried a kitten cry. He tried not to get in the way. The nursery nurse slammed the little round window shut. "We'll have to get this incubator repaired. The doors keep springing open all the time," she said. Eventually, the baby got better and Ellen took him home. The boys wished that they could go too, but somehow they couldn't go through the iron gates. They began to sing to the other babies, stroking them to get them to sleep. to make sure each lost one was never forgotten. The boys wove little crosses from iris leaves and stuck them in the bark of the big pine tree near the clinic. They said their prayers for the babies and wished that they could go to heaven as well. But Tom always said, "We must wait for our mam." The boys adopted the staff as their family and loved them all. But Joe, tired of his invisibility, he liked an audience so he could show off. Deprived, he became very naughty, his tricks more outrageous and dangerous. He mixed up the blood nurse's bottles in the clinic, put salt in Cook's apple pie, and unplugged the plugs on the switchboard, making the telephonists very flustered. "This must stop," said Tom, not often angry. "Why don't you go and play sword fencing with the pampas grass down by the boiler house? And do try to be good." Joe went too far on the day he tripped up the immaculately dressed consultant, who they called the Toff. He was on his way from the clinic to do his ward rounds. He fell down a deep hole and roared at the workmen, "Get me out of here at once. Don't you know I'm a consultant?" "You're just like any other bloke when you're down that hole," was the workman's reply. The old porter just laughed, and Joe rushed off to help him push the dinner wagon. The night nurses played a game with a circle of papers and a glass in the doctor's sitting room. The boys helped to push the glass. As it started to spell out strange words, the nurses screamed, and little Alfie, in excitement, threw a pack of playing cards up in the air, where all the hearts and diamonds, clubs and spades slid from the cards and danced around the ceiling as the bare cards fell to the floor. In that instant, Alfie knew that one nurse could see him. She turned and gave him such a lovely smile that he wished he could go home with her. The years still passed, but the times were not all sad. The boys had such happy days at the summer fairs. One of their favourite nurses made lovely toffee. There were cakes, and some children came in fancy dress. Once there was football, and Joe scored a goal and won the match. Soon the fun would end. There was talk of closure, and despite all the protests, petitions and marches, the hospital did close. Responsibility lay heavily on Tom's narrow shoulders. Where would they go, and how would he care for his brothers? Demolition day came. One by one, the buildings crashed and fell. The brothers fled from corner to corner, place to place, crouching under hedges in the dust and chaos. The three boys trudged wearily down the drive to the rusted iron gates, dodging trucks and demolition workers. "Look," Alfie pointed, "there's our nurse, the one who can see us. There she is beside the hedge, under the pine trees. Perhaps she will take us home, Tom. Perhaps she will take us home." "Please take us with you," begged Tom, but his voice blew away with the roar of the lorries. The nurse was shouting to them, "Watch out! Watch that lorry!" Her warning came too late. The lorry drove straight through the boys, but they stood there as before, together, holding hands. Tom stared in disbelief through the iron gates, his face enraptured, as he pointed to a familiar figure who came towards them from the lane with arms outstretched. "Ma'am, I always knew you would come back for us if we waited long enough," Tom whispered. They ran to her, and she hugged them and kissed them, clutching little Alfie up into her arms. The dust swirled and twirled around them, each mote of dust becoming an incandescent light, making patterns forever changing. When the dust settled, they were gone.
The Final Destination by Irene Stiles. The elderly lady wispy-haired and back-bent, hobbled slowly to the ticket desk just inside the railway station. The station was old and well-used locally, its interior rising to high vaulted ceilings of glass panes. "That will be £2.50, the ticket man spat at the old lady. He hadn't intended to be mean, but he had hardly slept that night, thinking about all the problems encroaching in on his life. The debt that would eventually lose him his wife and home. Shaking, age-spotted hands presented him with a £10 note, the only money she had left for the week. "Haven't you anything smaller?" he was about to snap. But looking at this small, frail lady in front of him, his manner changed, and he regretted his tone. Gently, he said, "That's okay, darling. I've got plenty of change." The old lady clumsily dropped the money and ticket into her purse, a 20-pence piece dropping and spinning on the ground. A young lady in the rapidly growing queue behind her stepped forward, picked it up and handed it back to her with a friendly smile. "Thank you very much," she said, and beamed at the young girl's kindness. Slowly, she shuffled to a seat near her platform and carefully, her joints stiffened aching, lowered herself down onto the bench. Comfortable at last, she sat and watched the people in the station milling to and fro, going about their busy lives. There was that kind young lady, running along the platform for the train that would no doubt be taking her to work. What was her life like, she wondered. This was what she had come for, to be among people, imagining other people's lives, because she felt she had no life of her own, not any more. She had felt so lonely since her sister had died 6 months earlier. They had shared everything, never marrying, and building a life and business together. They were each other's world, sharing hobbies and friends, likes and dislikes. That was all gone now. Perhaps their closeness had made them too insular. Their few friends were either dead, dying, or languishing in old people's homes, smelling of urine and sickly sweet air freshener to mask the smell. That wasn't for her. She had sold the business and intended to live out the rest of her life independently in her own home, the home they had shared. Her life felt so lonely, though. She didn't even need the train to take her to any destination, but it was a chance, perhaps, to strike up a conversation with another human being. Her train sped into the station. Wearily, she got up and tottered to the edge of the platform. The boarding step seemed a mile high, and she summoned up the strength to climb inside. Suddenly, strong arms grasped her and said, "Here, let me help you, missus." Once on board, she turned to face her helper. It was a young schoolboy, aged about 15. He had the loveliest smile she had ever seen. He helped her to get settled into her seat, winked at her, and wandered off down the corridor. The old lady waited, wanting him to return, but after 15 minutes she gave up, saying sadly to herself, "No conversation there, then." The train rumbled and swayed smoothly along the track, almost lulling her to sleep. There were few passengers on board. She sat wondering where the young boy had gone, probably to meet up with his other classmates, although this train would not get him to school on time. It was well after 10 o'clock now. Her thoughts drifted back to other times in her life, happy times. Suddenly there was a terrible screeching noise, and the train rocked violently. It shuddered and swayed. Windows shattered, glass flew everywhere. Cases, coats and bags flew through the air, landing with tremendous force, spraying their contents far and wide. Black Acrid smoke began to plume around the carriage. She could hear people coughing and choking. She heard cries and screams for help. Then, after what seemed like no time at all, the train came to an earth-shattering stop and keeled over onto its side. The old lady watched all this as if from afar. There had been no time to be frightened. Time seemed to have stopped. Everything, she noted, had seemed to have happened in slow and very detailed motion. Best of all, she noticed that she didn't hurt anywhere. "Take my hand, darling," she heard. It was that boy again. So helpful. So beautiful, in fact. And the sunlight seemed to dance around him. She took his hand, and he pulled her effortlessly from the chaos around her. "Follow me. We're here now," he said in such a gentle voice. "The journey has ended. You have reached your final destination, and your sister is waiting for you." Smiling, she followed him into the light.